No, you tell it.
No, you.
I'm not telling it.
You should totally tell it.
Well, you should tell it.
No, you tell it.
Hello, and welcome to Know You Tell It, a hybrid story incubator slash performance series. Each Know You Tell It participant develops their own nonfiction piece on the page, then switches with a partner to perform each other's work on stage. Because nothing informs your story like hearing someone else perform your story.
Today's Two on Tuesday stories are from our show, Uproar, recorded live at Jimmy's No. 43. Lyric tenor Peter Tenaglia is a graduate of the master's program in voice at Manhattan School of Music. In this story, he reflects on a horrifying undergraduate experience where a mere slip of the tongue led to unintended consequences. Here's Merritt Minnemeyer performing Ms. Lorimer, If You're Nasty, written by Peter Tenaglia.
Ms. Lorimer, If You're Nasty. The director of admissions for the College of Music was widely known to be a severe, taciturn administrator. When I walked into her office for the first time, she had a rigid bearing, but somehow struck me as half-finished. We limply shook hands. I took in her blocky, uneven shape. Her furrowed eyebrows and thin-lipped frown had carved a permanent scowl into her face, and her dated, oversized spectacles made her bulging eyes appear toad-like. The musty office was a stifling shoebox lacking windows and any discernible character. As the door creaked behind me, the puke olive shag carpeting and yellowing cinder block walls absorbed all sound. Our eyes locked. In that moment, I realized the musical town folk had long ago accepted that this was the closest thing to a sheriff they were ever going to get. But like those resigned town folk, I needed her. So I flashed my toothsome grin and steeled myself. This creature was about to decide my future at the university. Clearing my throat, I nervously began to talk about my path to the office of Ms. Hillary Lorimer. I was a complete train wreck my first year at university, I confessed. I was overextended, overtired, and afflicted with this insatiable desire to major in any subject I came into contact with, which was most of them. I was respectfully charming and self-deprecating, and I explained to Ms. Lorimer that when I started my second year, I was a pre-med psychology major in the College of Arts and Sciences, juggling three minors across four departments. The pot was about to boil over, and I knew I had to make a change, I said, winking at Ms. Lorimer as if discussing a naive young student we both knew. In response, she blinked occasionally and asked a few bland questions. I gave articulate answers and tried to ask insightful questions about the music school and her career, but it was obvious my mojo was not working. I changed tactics. I remember it clear as day, Ms. Lorimer. Last October, I walked into my advisor's office and boldly proclaimed that I had had an epiphany that morning. My advisor barely raised one eyebrow in solidarity. I guffawed at my own wit, while Ms. Lorimer barely suppressed a yawn. That was understandable given my track record, I conceded. But this time was different. It was different. My eyes smiled as I leaned forward to bring Ms. Lorimer in on the joke. She wasn't amused. She stared as if waiting for the punchline. I had known her for 5 minutes, and my ship had already hit the iceberg. I made a desperate move. It really was different, I said, with quiet confidence while looking at the floor. And then I met Ms. Lorimer's gaze, and I told her sincerely that it had been both simple and terrifying to admit. It was music, I said. I sang in choir, performed in shows, taught lessons. I did everything a typical music major does, except for the majoring part. Honestly, I should have started in the College of Music, but it took me a year of floundering around the College of Arts and Sciences to realize that medicine really wasn't the career for me, and those minors were just fluff. The way forward was clear. I had to add a music degree. Excitedly, I caught a glimmer of sympathy in Ms. Lorimer's eye. So I barreled onward with my story. I told my advisor that I would keep my psychology degree, but drop everything else so that I could start pursuing an additional music degree immediately. I'd needed my advisor's signature to authorize my transfer to music school, and then I would be on the road to true happiness. Suddenly, Ms. Lorimer's smile wasn't as constipated, and her glare warmed a few degrees. I had made it to a lifeboat. I rallied and told her that after my advisor blessed the transfer, I practically skipped all the way to the College of Music, humming, "I have confidence in me!" I nervously ascended the stairs to the dean's office, hastily introduced myself to her assistant, and begged for an emergency sit-down. Wary, but compassionate, she buzzed the dean and nodded me in. I composed myself and did my best impression of a candidate at a job interview. The dean was intrigued as I outlined my plans and experience and explained why I needed to add this music degree. I had a PowerPoint with animated transitions and sound effects. Initially, she was skeptical, but shiny lights from my PowerPoint must have been hypnotic. I sold her on it in less than 5 minutes. My passion and newfound focus after a rough start inspired her. She reviewed my advisor's write-ups with lots of nods and active listening noises, and I smugly congratulated myself on how all easy it seemed to flow. She told me that a vocal audition and formal application would follow, but for now, I was in, and I needed to start attending music classes right away so I wouldn't get behind while the paperwork played out. I went straight to the registrar to enroll, and an hour later, I was a music student. "So, in effect," I said proudly to Ms. Lorimer, "I added a music degree in one day." Now, had I allowed her to speak at some point during my testimony, I might have noticed that her smile had begun to fade back into that stony glower. But with the stakes so high, I felt compelled to give her every detail about without coming up for air. "In my second year," I said, continued obliviously, "I grew so much as a musician." I relaxed into the chair and rambled on about how much I read and how hard I practiced and how I went to every class, even the early ones. I picked up steam as I told Ms. Lorimer that I hadn't been shy about introducing myself to my professors, and they were all proud of how I really turned around my academic performance. "And so now I'm here," I exhaled too aggressively, and Ms. Lorimer blinked uncomfortably as wisps of her stringy hair fluttered in all directions. I said that I was nervous, of course, but so thrilled to finally meet the music school director of admissions. I said that, at first, meeting her at this point seemed strange after being enrolled for a year already, but I had learned through careful research that the music school required all students to clear hurdles before their third year, and we had to pass a series of juries and interviews like this one in order to be admitted to the school as a major, and that if I didn't pass, out I'd go. I was blathering on with such conviction that it took me a minute to realize that she had stopped listening to me. She was simply staring. As I took in her expression, I noticed her left eye was twitching slightly. And then both eyes started quivering, caught in a horrible rictus. I thought I might have to ask her if she smelled toast. And then she broke her stare and rummaged violently through my paperwork for a few moments, making a confusing show of searching for something. She stopped abruptly and glared again. The incriminating purse of her lips reminded me of my aunt. She hates children. After an excruciatingly long silence, I was afraid to ask if she had any questions. Eventually, she closed her eyes, took off her glasses. Why do they always take off their glasses? And started massaging the oily bridge of her nose. "Oh, no," I said. "I didn't realize my grades were that bad. I'll take summer school. I'll do independent study. Anything." She jerked her head up and barked. "I'm just trying to understand how you managed to hoodwink this entire school." "I'm sorry?" I stammered. "I don't understand." "Your transcripts show that you've been spent this entire year enrolled in music classes. Somehow you managed to do that without being admitted to the school. I assume you lied to the registrar and all of your professors. Only students of the music school can register for music classes, she explained, as if to a simpleton. There must be some misunderstanding, I reassured her. I met with the dean, and she gave me permission. My advisor knew about this. The registrar let me into the classes I needed so I wouldn't be behind. I auditioned. I didn't hide anything. I was flummoxed. Why was she assuming I had circumvented the process? My back talk only incensed her more. I personally sign all acceptance letters, and I always remember exceptional cases like dual degree students. I know for a fact, she emphasized each word with a pound on her desk, that I never signed your acceptance letter. She pulled up my student record online to corroborate her claim. It's right there, in the system. She turned her monitor sharply in my direction, as if laying my sinister plan bare. You're coded as a student in the College of Arts and Sciences only. She made the word sound so ugly. She slammed my file closed and folded her hands over it with a jarring thud. Now, I just have to figure out what to do with you. This sheriff was going to hogtie me to the back of her Segway and roll me to the back. My mind was spinning and I could barely breathe. Dr. Williams is my advisor. Please speak to her. Dr. Walling's had me for 3 quarters this year and can attest to my integrity. More rambling. I was drowning, grasping at anything that might save me. And then, for reasons I will never understand, I said, please, I swear to you, Hillary, I didn't do anything. Hillary. I called her by her Christian name. The thing is, I honestly didn't mean any disrespect. Everyone called her Hillary, the dean, the students, probably the janitor. And they did so to her face. It's not like it was some sordid secret. Hillary just came out without thinking. And I was too young to realize how I had just made the situation so much worse. The look she gave me was a vile combination of shock, disgust, and offense. At first, her jaw just flapped silently. And then admonishments started stumbling out in a tangled mess. Barely restraining her rage, she managed one coherent thought. Hillary, my name is Ms. Lorimer. You call Dr. Williams, Dr. Williams, and Dr. Wallings, Dr. Wallings. Why am I Hillary? Thankfully, I had the presence of mind not to blurt out that everyone called her Hillary, and instead offered numerous apologies and several Ms. Lorimers for good measure. I insisted that I had the highest respect for her and that I was just caught off guard by her claims. I begged her forgiveness and pleaded that she just call my professors, that surely they would vouch for me. Conversation was over. She gave me a curt dismissal and said she'd be in touch. I shambled like a zombie back to my apartment. It seemed that all the fretting over my poor academic performance had been pointless. Clearly, Ms. Lorimer was going to sandbag me over a naive, albeit serious, faux pas, and a completely inaccurate understanding of how I got to her office. As luck would have it, though, I wasn't the only person to get ridden hard and put up wet that day. Over the next week, I was asked to repeat every detail of my story to the provost, the registrar, the deans of both my colleges. Eventually, I was told that a process error had been discovered. Apparently, you don't have to be enrolled in the College of Music to register for music class, and everyone at the music school had now been briefed on the details of my situation. Oh, and the dean had forgotten to tell Ms. Lorimer that she had admitted me on her authority. Oops. The vice president for academic affairs personally apologized for any misunderstanding and advised me that a detailed investigation was being conducted into how such a glaring oversight could have escaped the notice of everyone involved. He assured me that although I hadn't broken any rules, technically, my pathway to the music school revealed that there were loopholes in the system, and they very much appreciated my help in uncovering them. Eventually, rumor had it that two people were fired over the whole mess, although I never found out who. Other rumors said that Ms. Lorimer had physically threatened me, and that my parents had, in turn, threatened to sue the school over my mental and emotional abuse. The real truth is that 1 month later, without any warning or comment from the administration, I received an acceptance letter from the College of Music on Southworth ivory, 32-pound, 100% cotton fiber letterhead. She probably smelled toast when she signed it. I never saw her again. But the last I heard, she was working in some small liberal arts college in a state that's trying to secede from the union. Sometimes I think about writing her a letter to cry how her unwarranted, unprovoked tirade still causes a former student emotional trauma. Sometimes I wonder, if I hadn't called her Hillary, would everything still have come to a head? We'll never know. But if a student of mine ever calls me Peter, I will simply smile, casually adjust my doctoral diploma on the wall, and tell them about my date with the incomparable Ms. Lorimer.
Now, switching it up, educator, author, performer, and mother of three, Merritt Minnemeyer writes about losing a loved one and how to care for the ones left behind. Here's Peter Tenaglia performing Morning Becomes Elijah by Merritt Minnemeyer.
Morning becomes Elijah. Grumpy and disheveled, he shuffles up to perch precariously on the low edge of the bed. The comforter creases gently under his slight frame. He pauses for a moment, contemplating the jump into the harrowing first moments of the daily war. The sparkle that once floated with ethereal ease from his chestnut eyes and effusive smile is muted today, though still burns with low light. Such a handsome little chap, this 8-year-old, who has borne a lifetime of heartbreak. His rock star hair, slick with 3 days of wear, is heavy and fluid with his shallow breathing. Tremendous loss presses on his tiny shoulders. The gravity of his fraying family causes him to lean forward, a little uneven. Daddy's song is gone. His cheer, his breath, his heartbeat, stolen. This disquieting hum, devoid of his father's voice, is still wet and fresh and brutally oppressive to a son's desperate ears. People tell him he is the man of the house now. If only he could figure out what that means, maybe facing each morning wouldn't be so terrifying. He sends 1 foot down the denim chute, then the other, like always. A routine he has employed for as long as he can remember, yet now feels to him as if it might be the most insurmountable of hurdles. Smoldering, he assimilates into the conditions expected of him, first with cotton armor, and then a bit of wool pulled over the top to resist the chill. Time, class, practice, homework, bus here, carpool there. Who cares about any of it? All of that is just what grown-ups use to make life less fun, less worth it. And what exactly is the point, anyway? Eyes turned down, he seeks a good reason, any reason, to take the leap onto the floor and breach the barrier between the bed and the eternal day ahead. He'll see his friends there at school, sure, and it is pizza day, so that's something. Finally free of the comfort of the duvet, he drags each step behind the next. The drudgery of the mundane. Teeth, comb, face, breakfast, a vile, unwelcome chore on his stomach, already sour with worry. This is his solemn march towards what is keeping him from falling apart. I begin to hustle him, gently at first, followed too quickly with impatience. It is not long before I am pleading for any sign of buy-in to the construct of the clock. His sluggish pace is a garish affront to the slim sense of order I attempt, with great effort and pathetic little efficacy, to uphold it. His lack of response communicates volumes. My hustle turns to panic. I call to him, overwrought with urgency. He offers no response to the fifth and sixth bid for boots. He is aggressively disengaged in this moment. Flustered, I spout some exasperated snip in his direction and then begin to sense his diligently preserved rage. I confront his face with mine. Daggers spill from his gaze. The thought of bleeding is a reminder of any sort of sensation other than sorrow. His emotional mutiny is tempered only by the greater fear of another loss, so he does not cross the border into wishing me actual harm. But there is an ever-increasing intensity embedded in the commentary of his restraint. We both are drenched in exhaustion from these terrible habits we have formed recently. Every morning, I try on the facade of chipperness only for him to dismantle it with his insistence on honest brooding. When his anger is most searing, he sometimes wishes it was me who was spirited away by that monster, glioblastoma. When my despair is most overwhelming, I wish the same. Again, I beg for compliance, my nags sharpening with the threat of punitive dare. He is challenging my pretense, begging me to fess up and deal with all of the unspoken hysteria within these weeping walls. Come on, I bark, the heat rising within me. Let's go, we're going to be late for the bus. Again. Whatever. You don't love me anyway. You're just mean. Daddy loved me more than you do. In a flash of fitful, mindless fury, I growl like a wild animal. Grabbing hold of his sinewy upper arms, I shout loud enough for the neighbors to hear, "Why won't you just do what I tell you? Just because your dad is dead, you think you can act like a spoiled brat? Who do you think you are? Let me tell you something, kid. The world doesn't owe you a goddamn thing." The dominoes fall. His baby brown, sloppy with pools that his chin hides, all tucked away in his chest. Crestfallen, he quietly shivers through tears. It is his fault to him. All of it. I am beside myself with disproportionate fury and cinching guilt. My first child, my purest joy, now turned to reflect my most egregious disappointment in myself. He's a buoyant child, noted for bringing sweetness and spry laughter to every situation. But not with me. With me, he exposes each crevice of his sorrow and spits it with every third word. The man of the house. Good God, what ridiculousness. How can anyone expect this boy to play such a role when the best man he has ever known is relegated to ephemeral memory? How can I possibly want him to be a grown-up when I can barely show up myself? He terrifies me. The pain he carries. I have sworn to protect this sweet little precious soul, and just now I have scratched off a chunk of him with a mother's malicious tongue. This voice that cooed the night he came into the world and pledged to be trustworthy with his spirit. This voice that told him that his best friend, his most willing playmate and glorious hero, was never coming back. The voice that is meant to soothe and to heal now turned into a bitter rapier to further flay his already dilapidated faith. After the eternal car ride to school, having indeed missed the bus yet again, I take silence as an opening. Looking straight on into those gorgeous, soulful 8-year-old eyes, I grab a hold of his upper arms again, this time with all the tender reassurance and remorse I can muster, and say, I love you, buddy, and I'm sorry. Really very sorry for yelling the way I did. We're a team, and we need to act like it. I reach for his hand, sweaty with nerves, in a gesture of reconciliatory hopefulness. And in a momentary miracle, he takes it. Yeah, he concedes, the corner of his mouth hinting at forgiveness. We both do. Mom, come see! A month has passed since that dreadful exchange, and we find ourselves one exquisite autumn afternoon in the most unlikely and yet most inevitable of settings. As we traverse this yard of graves, my lanky man cub darts about the monument, luring me with his blinky half-cop grin to join in the exploration of death, of life. The crisp of trees shedding the old shakes and swooshes above our heads. The breeze is scented with cider and squash. 'Tis the season of ghosts and demons. Yet today, this hallowed ground is bereft of its monotonous morbidity. He has been asking to come here for weeks. We are surrounded by wonder of those who lay here, whose bodies are at rest and whose spirits have joined the ranks of the greater. He sprinkles his exuberance amongst homages to lives lived in love, or in pain, or in honor, or in full, or perhaps not at all. Their existence here marked for the masses. Geese scatter and sound off in the wake of his boyish charge, alerting their comrades to his silly sauntering and heralding the cold looming ahead, his pant legs sopping. He innocently awakens the somber stillness of the memorial reflection pool as he sends ripples of jubilance across its face. This is not a place of sadness today, but a place of stories, adventures had, beauty expressed, dreams realized, love witnessed, community with those who have moved through. He peeks into the windows, inquires about dates, skips the knolls, sings to himself in broken schoolyard verse. His levity is an antidote to what could be morose and horrifically sad. It's one of his most awe-inspiring qualities, to experience magic wherever he chooses. To an outside eye, it would appear that this child does not appreciate the essence of severity implied here. To some, his joie de vivre would seem an irreverent counterpoint to proprietary melancholy. Yet, to know this child is to understand one who has contended intimately with death. A profound injury knitted clumsily into his sweet tapestry, imperfect with inordinate wounds already. Here, where most would expect the palette of mourning to be most awash with morose hues, he is making peace. Mausoleums are really expensive, he reasons, then canters off to another option. This plaque would work. We could put his ashes here like this one, maybe Daddy's picture next to it. He traces an epitaph with brass-stained fingers. He pursues his own ritual of reconciliation. If he is sad now, he doesn't reveal it. Rather, for these brief minutes, he is energized by the freedom to soak in this facet of humanness. A comfort begins to settle in the chasm of his aching chest, a serenity in the acceptance of impermanence. That this little person is able to assume such cargo with the maturity that some of us, three times his age, have not been able to model, at least not with his consistency, is a marvel. That is his blessing. And his burden, too. He does falter, of course, but somehow the ratio of his missteps to mine seem grossly out of order. After all, he's a kid. While his elders are mostly diligent about laying too much of adulthood at his feet, it seems that our efforts are largely insufficient. He knows much of this world. More often than not, he chooses to greet it with great joy. Remarkable, that little man. Later he will tell how the tree next to the plot will likely bloom early, and that the headstones nearby coordinate well with the hedges just behind them. When asked how he feels about choosing his father's final resting place, he will dismiss it as no big deal. And perhaps in the grand scheme, it wasn't. But for a mom, watching my darling boy mend his wee heart, it was bearing witness to a morsel of the lovely, simple slice of normalcy in what has been an abhorrently abnormal circumstance. He is courageous and loving and curious and working it all out. He is rolling along the path to the light of childhood and illuminating the way for those of us trailing behind. Just another walk in the park.
That's it. Thanks for joining us for this installment of Know You Tell It.
Visit us on the web at knowyoutellit.com.